The fool peered into the gloom. It dawned on him that while he liked forests, he liked them at one remove, as it were. It was nice to know that they were there, but the forests of the mind were not quite the same as real forests that, for example, you got lost in. They had more mighty oaks and fewer brambles. They also tended to be viewed in daylight, and the trees didn't have malevolent faces and long scratchy branches. The trees of the imagination were proud giants of the forest. Most of the trees here appeared to be vegetable gnomes, mere trellises for fungi and ivy. The fool was vaguely aware that you could tell which direction the hub lay by seeing which side of the trees the moss grew on. A quick inspection of the nearby trunks indicated that, in defiance of all normal geography, the hub lay everywhere. Gribo had vanished. The fool sighed, removed his chainmail protection, and tinkled gently through the night in search of high ground. High ground seemed a good idea. The ground he was on at the moment appeared to be trembling. He wasn't sure it should do that. McGrat hovered on her broomstick several hundred feet above the turnwise borders of Loncra, looking down on a sea mist through which an occasional treetop poked like a seaweed-covered rock at high tide. A bulging moon floated above her, probably gibbous again. Even a decent thin crescent would have been better, she felt, more appropriate. She shivered and wondered where Granny Weatherwax was at this moment. The old witch's broomstick was known and feared throughout the skies of Loncra. Granny had been introduced to flying quite late in life, and after some initial suspicion had taken to it like a blue bottle to an ancient fish head. A problem, however, was that Granny saw every flight simply as a straight line from A to B, and was unable to get alongside the idea that other users of the air might have any rights whatsoever. The flight migration patterns of an entire continent had been changed because of that simple fact. High-speed evolution among local birds had developed a generation that flew on their backs, so that they could keep a watchful eye on the skies. Granny's implicit belief that everything should get out of her way extended to other witches, very tall trees, and, on occasion, mountains. Granny had also browbeaten the dwarfs who lived under the mountains and in fear of their lives into speeding the thing up. Many an egg had been laid in mid-air by unsuspecting fowls who had suddenly glimpsed Granny bearing down on them, scowling over the top of the broomstick. "Oh, dear," thought McGrat. "I hope she hasn't happened to someone." A midnight breeze turned her gently around in the air like an unsupported weathercock. She shivered and squinted at the moonlit mountains, the high ramtops whose freezing crags and ice-green chasms acknowledged no king or cartographer. Only on the Rimwood side was Loncra open to the world. The rest of its borders looked as jagged as a wolf's mouth and far more impassable. From up here, it was possible to see the whole kingdom. There was a ripping noise in the sky above her, a blast of wind that spun her around again, and a Doppler-distorted cry of, "Stop dreaming, girl!" She gripped the bristles with her knees and urged the stick upwards. It took several minutes to catch up with Granny, who was lying almost full length along her broomstick to reduce wind resistance. Dark treetops roared far below them as McGrat came alongside. Granny turned to her, holding her hat on with one hand.
"Not before time," she snapped. "I don't reckon this one's got more'n a few minutes' flight left. Come on, get a move on."
She reached out a hand. So did McGrat. Unsteadily, the broomsticks bucking and dipping in one another's slipstreams, they touched fingertips. McGrat's arm tingled as the power flowed up it. Possibly the first attempt at the in-flight refueling of a broomstick. Granny's broomstick jerked forwards.
"Leave me a bit," shouted McGrat. "I've got to get down."
"Shouldn't be difficult,"
screamed Granny above the noise of the wind.
"I mean get down safely."
"You're a witch, ain't you? By the way, Did you bring the cocoa? I'm freezing up here.
McGrath nodded desperately, and with her spare hand, passed up a straw bag.
Right, said Granny. Well done. See you at Lonkra Bridge.
She uncurled her fingers. McGrath whirled away in the buffeting wind, clinging tightly to a broomstick which now, she feared, had about as much buoyancy as a bit of firewood, but certainly wasn't capable of sustaining a full-grown woman against the beckoning fingers of gravity. As she plunged down towards the forest roof, in a long, shallow dive, she reflected that there was possibly something complimentary in the way Granny Weatherwax resolutely refused to consider other people's problems. It implied that, in her considerable opinion, they were quite capable of sorting them out by themselves. Some kind of change spell was probably in order. McGrath concentrated. Well, that seemed to work. Nothing in the sight of mortal man had in fact changed. What McGrath had achieved was a mere adjustment of the mental processes from a bewildered and slightly frightened woman gliding inexorably towards the inhospitable ground to a clear-headed, optimistic and positive-thinking woman who had really got it together, was taking full responsibility for her own life, and in general knew where she was coming from, although, unfortunately, where she was heading had not changed in any way, but she felt a lot better about it. She dug her heels in and forced the broomstick to yield the last dregs of its power in a brief burst, sending it skimming erratically a few feet from the trees. As it sagged again and started to plough a furrow among the midnight leaves, she tensed herself, prayed to whatever gods of the forest might be listening that she would land on something soft, and let go. There are 3,000 known major gods on the disk, and research theologians discover more every week. Apart from the minor gods of rock, tree, and water, there are two that haunt the Ramtops. Hoki, half a man, half a goat, and entirely a bad practical joker, who was banished from Dun Manifestin for pulling the old exploding mistletoe joke on blind Io, chief of all the gods. And also Herne the Hunted, the terrified and apprehensive deity of all small furry creatures whose destiny it is to end their lives as a brief, crunchy squeak. Either could have been candidates for the small miracle which then occurred, for in a forest full of cold rocks, jagged stumps and thorn bushes, McGrath landed on something soft. Granny, meanwhile, was accelerating towards the mountains on the second leg of the journey. She consumed the regrettably tepid cocoa and, with proper environmental consideration, dropped the bottle as she passed over an upland lake. It turned out that McGrath's idea of sustaining food was two rounds of egg and cress sandwiches, with the crusts cut off, and Granny noticed, before the wind whipped it away, a small piece of parsley placed with consideration and care on top of each one. Granny regarded them for some time. Then she ate them. A chasm loomed, still choked with winter snow, like a tiny spark in the darkness, a dot of light against the hugeness of the Ramtops. Granny tackled the maze of the mountains. Back in the forest, McGrath sat up and absent-mindedly pulled a twig from her hair. A few yards away, the broomstick dropped through the trees, showering leaves. A groan and a small, half-hearted tinkle caused her to peer into the gloom. An instinct figure was on its hands and knees searching for something. "Did I land on you?" said McGrath. "Someone did," said the fool. They crawled nearer to one another.
You? What are you doing here?
Mary, I was walking along the ground, said the fool. A lot of people do. You know what I mean? I know it's been done before. It's not original. Probably lacks imagination, but, well, it's always been good enough for me.
Did I hurt you?
I think I've got one or two bells that won't be the same again.
The fool scrabbled through the leaf mould and finally located his hated hat.
It clonked.
"Totally crushed, i' faith,"
he said, putting it on anyway. He seemed to feel better for that, and went on,
"Rain, yes?
Hail, yes. Even lumps of rock. Fish and small frogs, okay. Women, no, up till now. Is it going to happen again?
You've got a bloody hard head, said McGrath, pulling herself to her feet.
Modesty forbids me to comment, said the fool, and then remembered himself and added quickly, Prithee. They stared at one another again, their minds racing. McGrath thought, Nanny said look at him properly. I'm looking at him. He just looks the same. A sad, thin little man in a ridiculous jester's outfit. He's practically a hunchback. Then, in the same way that a few random bulges in a cloud can suddenly become a galleon or a whale in the eye of the beholder, McGrath realized that the fool was not a little man. He was at least of average height, but he made himself small by hunching his shoulders, bandying his legs, and walking in a half-crouch that made him appear as though he was capering on the spot. I wonder what else Geitha Og noticed, she thought, intrigued. He rubbed his arm and gave her a lopsided grin. I suppose you haven't got any idea where we are, he said.
Witches never get lost, said McGrath firmly.
Although they can become temporarily mislaid.
Lonkra's over that way, I think. I've got to find a hill, if you'll excuse me.
To see where you are?
To see when, I think.
There's a lot of magic going on tonight.
Is there?
Then I think I'll accompany you, the fool added chivalrously, after peering cautiously into the tree-haunted gloom that apparently lay between him and his flagstones. I wouldn't want anything to happen to you.
Granny lay low over the broomstick as it plunged through the trackless chasms of the mountains, leaning from side to side in the hope that this may have some effect on the steering, which seemed strangely to be getting worse. Falling snow behind her was whipped and spiralled into odd shapes by the wind of her passage. Rearing waves of crusted snow poised all winter over the glacial valleys, trembled, and then began the long, silent fall. Her flight was punctuated by the occasional boom of an avalanche. She looked down at the landscape of sudden death and jagged beauty, and knew it was looking back at her, as a dozing man may watch a mosquito. She wondered if it realized what she was doing. She wondered if it had made her fall any softer, and mentally scolded herself for such softness. Oh, the land wasn't like that. It didn't bargain. The land gave hard and took hard. A dog always bit deepest on the veterinary hand. And then she was through, vaulting so low over the last peak that one of her boots filled with snow, and barreling down towards the lowlands, knives underneath. He'd seen priests, their fantastic costumes only slightly marred by the long rubber sacrificial aprons they wore for major services. Every trade and profession had its costume, he saw, and he realized for the first time that the uniform he was wearing had been carefully and meticulously designed for no other purpose than making its wearer look like a complete and utter pillock. Even so, he'd persevered. He'd spent his whole life persevering. He'd persevered precisely because he had absolutely no talent, and because his grandfather would have flayed him alive if he didn't. He'd memorized the authorized jokes until his head rang, and got up even earlier in the morning to juggle until his elbows creaked. He had perfected his grasp of comic vocabulary until only the very senior lords could understand him. He'd capered and clowned with an impenetrable, grim determination, and he'd graduated top of his year and had been awarded the Bladder of Honour. He'd dropped it down the privy when he came home. McGrath was silent. The fool said, How did you get to be a witch?
I mean, did you go to school or something?
Oh, no. Goody Wimper just walked down to the village one day, got all us girls lined up and chose me. You don't choose the craft, you see. It chooses you.
Yes, but when do you actually become a witch?
When the other witches treat you as one, I suppose. McGrath sighed.
If they ever do, she added. I thought they would after I did that spell in the corridor. It was pretty good after all.
Marry, 'twas a rite of passage, said the fool, unable to stop himself.
McGrath gave him a blank look. He coughed.
The other witches being those two old ladies, he said, relapsing into his usual gloom.
Yes.
Very strong characters, I imagine.
Very,
said McGrath with feeling. I wonder if they ever met my grandad, said the fool. McGrath looked at her feet.
They're quite nice, really, she said. It's just that, well, when you're a witch, you don't think about other people. I mean, you think about them, but you don't actually think about their feelings, if you see what I mean. At least, not unless you think about it.
She looked at her feet again.
You're not like that, said the fool.
Look, I wish you'd stop working for the Duke, said McGrath desperately. You know what he's like, torturing people and setting fire to their cottages and everything.
But I'm his fool, said the fool. A fool has to be loyal to his master, right up until he dies. I'm afraid it's tradition. Tradition is very important.
But you don't even like being a fool.
I hate it. But that's got nothing to do with it. If I've got to be a fool, I'll do it properly.
That's really stupid, said McGrath.
Foolish, I'd prefer.
The fool had been edging along the log.
If I kiss you, he added carefully, do I turn into a frog?
McGrath looked down at her feet again. They shuffled themselves under her dress, embarrassed at all this attention. She could sense the shades of Gaitha Og and Esme Weatherwax on either side of her. Granny Spectre glared at her.
A witch is master of every situation, it said.
Mistress, said the vision of Nanny Og, and made a brief gesture involving much grinning and waving of forearms.
We shall have to see, she said. It was destined to be the most impressive kiss in the history of foreplay. Time, as Granny Weatherwax had pointed out, is a subjective experience. The fool's years in the guild had been an eternity, whereas the hours with McGrath on the hilltop passed like a couple of minutes. And high above Lancre, a double handful of seconds extended like taffy into hours of screaming terror.
Ice! Screamed Granny. It's iced up!
Nanny Og came alongside, trying vainly to match courses with the tumbling, bucking broomstick. Octarine fire crackled over the frozen bristles, shorting them out at random. She leaned over and snatched a handful of Granny's skirt.
I told you it was daft, she shouted. You went all through all that wet mist and then up into the cold air, you daft bism. You let go of my skirt, Gaitha Og. Come on, grab hold of mine. You're on fire at the back there.
They shot through the bottom of the cloud bank and screamed in unison as the shrub-covered ground emerged from nowhere and aimed itself directly at them and went past. Nanny looked down a black perspective at the bottom of which a boil of white water was dimly visible. They had flown over the edge of Lancre Gorge. Blue smoke was pouring out of Granny's broomstick, but she hung on, determined, and forced it around.
"What the hell are you doing?" roared Nanny. "I can follow the river!"
Granny Weatherwax screamed above the crackle of flames.
"Don't you worry! You come aboard, you hear? It's all over. You can't do it."
There was a small explosion behind Granny, and several handfuls of burning bristles broke off and whirled away into the booming depths of the gorge. Her stick jerked sideways, and Nanny grabbed her around the shoulders as a gout of fire snapped off another binding. The blazing broomstick shot from between her legs, twisted in the air, and went straight upwards, trailing sparks and making a noise like a wet finger dragged around the top of a wine glass. This left Nanny flying upside down, supporting Granny Weatherwax at arm's length, They stared into one another's faces and screamed,
"I can't pull you up!" "Well, I can't climb up, can I, at your age, Gaither?"
Nanny considered this. Then she let go. Three marriages and an adventurous girlhood had left Nanny Ogg with thigh muscles that could crack coconuts, and the G-forces sucked her as she forced the speeding stick down and around in a tight loop. Ahead of her, she made out Granny Weatherwax dropping like a stone, one hand clutching her hat, the other trying to prevent gravity from seeing up her skirts. She urged the stick forwards until it creaked, snatched the falling witch around the waist, fought the plunging stick back up to level flight, and sagged. The subsequent silence was broken by Granny Weatherwax saying,
"Don't you ever do that again, Gaither Ogg."
"I promise."
"Now turn us around. We're heading for Lonkra Bridge, remember?"
"Black Alice never done anything like it," said Nanny encouragingly. "I mean, it was 100 years, all right, but it was only one castle she moved. I reckon anyone could do a castle."
Granny's frown puckered at the edge.
"And she let all weeds grow over it," she observed primly. "Right enough."
"Very well done," said King Varence eagerly. "We all thought it was superb. Being in the ethereal plane, of course, we were in a position to observe closely."
"Very good, your graciousness," said Nanny Ogg.
She turned and observed the crowding ghosts behind him, who hadn't been granted the privilege of sitting at, or partly through, the kitchen table.
"But you lot can bugger off back to the outhouse," she said. "The cheek! Except the kiddies. They can stay," she added. "Poor little mites."
"I'm afraid it feels so good to be out of the castle," said the king.
Granny Weatherwax yawned.
"Anyway," she said, "we've got to find the boy now. That's the next step."
"We shall look for him directly after lunch."
"Lunch?"
"It's chicken," said Nanny. "And you're tired. Besides, making a decent search will take a long time."
"He'll be an Ankh Morpork," said Granny. "Mark my words, everyone ends up there. We'll start with Ankh Morpork. You don't have to search for people when destiny is involved. You just wait for them in Ankh Morpork."
Nanny brightened up.
"Our Karen got married to an innkeeper from there. I haven't seen the baby yet. We could get free board and everything."
"We needn't actually go. The whole point is that he should come here. There's something about that city," said Granny. "It's like a drain."
"It's 500 miles away," said McGrath. "You'll be away for ages." "I can't help it," said the fool. "The Duke's given me special instructions. He trusts me."
"Huh. To hire more soldiers, I expect."
"No, nothing like that. Not as bad as that." The fool hesitated. He'd introduced Felmet to the world of words. Surely that was better than hitting people with swords. Wouldn't that buy time? Wouldn't it be best for everybody, in the circumstances?
"But you don't have to go. You don't want to go."
"That doesn't have much to do with it. I promised to be loyal to him."
"Yes, yes, until you're dead. But you don't even believe that. You were telling me how much you hated the whole guild and everything."
"Well, yes, but I still have to do it. I gave my word." McGrath came close to stamping her foot, but didn't sink so low.
"Just when we were getting to know one another," she shouted. "You're pathetic."
The fool's eyes narrowed. "I'd only be pathetic if I broke my word," he said. "But I may be incredibly ill-advised. I'm sorry. I'll be back in a few weeks, anyway."
"Don't you understand? I'm asking you not to listen to him."
"I said I'm sorry. I couldn't see you again before I go, could I?"
"I'll be washing my hair," said McGrath stiffly.
"When?"
"Whenever."
Howell pinched the bridge of his nose, and squinted wearily at the wax-spattered paper. The play wasn't going well at all. He'd sorted out the falling chandelier and found a place for a villain who wore a mask to conceal his disfigurement, and he'd rewritten one of the funny bits to allow for the fact that the hero had been born in a handbag. It was the clowns who were giving him trouble again. They kept changing every time he thought about them. He preferred them in twos, that was traditional, but now there seemed to be a third one, and he was blowed if he could think of any funny lines for him. His quill moved scratchily over the latest sheet of paper, trying to catch the voices that had streamed through his dreaming mind and had seemed so funny at the time. His tongue began to stick out of the corner of his mouth. He was sweating.
"This is my little study," he wrote. "Hey, with a little study, you could go a long way. And I wish you'd start now. If you can't leave in a cab, then leave in a huff. If that's too soon, then leave in a minute and a half. Say, you got a pencil? A crayon?"
Hal stared at this in horror. On the page it looked nonsensical, ridiculous, and yet, in the thronged auditorium of his mind, he dipped the quill in the inkpot and chased the echoes further.
"Second clown. That's a right boss. Third clown. Business with bladder on stick. Honk, honk."
Howell gave up. Yes, it was funny. He knew it was funny. He'd heard the laughter in his dreams, but it wasn't right. Not yet. Maybe never. It was like the other idea he had about two clowns, one fat, one thin.
"This is a mean, dainty mess you've gotten me into, Stanley."
He had laughed until his chest ached, and the rest of the company had looked at him in astonishment, but in his dreams it was hilarious. He laid down the pen and rubbed his eyes. It must be nearly midnight. And the habit of a lifetime told him to spare the candles, although, for a fact, they could afford all the candles they could eat now, whatever Vitola might say. Hour gongs were being struck all across the city, and night watchmen were proclaiming that it was indeed midnight, and also that, in the face of all the evidence, all was well. Many of them got as far as the end of the sentence before being mugged. Howell pushed open the shutters and looked out at Ankh Morpork. It would be tempting to say the Twin City was at its best this time of year, but that wouldn't be entirely correct. It was at its most typical. The River Ankh, the cloaca of half a continent, was already pretty wide and silt-laden when it reached the city's outskirts. By the time it left, it didn't so much flow as exude. Owing to the accretion of the mud of centuries, the bed of the river was in fact higher than some of the low-lying areas, and now, with the snow-melt swelling the flow, many of the low-rent districts of the Morpork side were flooded. If you can use that word for a liquid you could pick up in a net. This sort of thing happened every year, and would have caused havoc with the drains and the sewage systems, so it is just as well that the city didn't have very many. Its inhabitants merely kept a punt handy in the backyard, and periodically built another story on the house. It was reckoned to be very healthy there. Very few germs were able to survive. Howell looked across a sort of misty sea in which buildings clustered like a sandcastle competition at high tide. Dwarf's voice trailed off. Tom John's face had that familiar expression of polite and slightly condescending puzzlement that Howell had come to know and dread.
"Anyway, it was very amusing," he said, half to himself.
But he knew he'd never convince the rest of the company. If it didn't have a custard pie in it somewhere, they said it wasn't funny. Tom John swung his legs out of bed and reached for his breeches.
"I'm not going back to sleep," he said. "What's the time?"
"It's after midnight," said Howell. "And you know what your father said about going to bed late?"
"I'm not," said Tom John, pulling on his boots. "I'm getting up early. Getting up early is very healthy, and now I'm going out for a very healthy drink. You can come too," he added, "to keep an eye on me."
Howell gave him a doubting look.
"You also know what your father said about going out drinking," he said.
"Yes, He said he used to do it all the time when he was a lad. He said he'd think nothing of quaffing ale all night and coming home at 5 a.m, smashing windows. He said he was a bit of a roister-doister, not like these white-livered people today who can't hold their drink.
Tom John adjusted his doublet in front of the mirror and added, "You know, Howell, I reckon responsible behaviour is something you get when you grow older, like varicose veins." Howell sighed. Tom John's memory for ill-judged remarks was legendary.
"All right," he said. "Just the one, though. Somewhere decent."
"I promise."
Tom John adjusted his hat. It had a feather in it.
"By the way," he said, "exactly how does one quaff?"
"I think it means you spill most of it," said Howell.
If the water of the River Ankh was rather thicker and more full of personality than ordinary river water, so the air in the mended drum was more crowded than normal air. It was like dry fog. Tom John and Howell watched it spilling out into the street. The door burst open, and a man came through backwards, not actually touching the ground until he hit the wall on the opposite side of the street. An enormous troll, employed by the owners to keep a measure of order in the place, came out dragging two more limp bodies which he deposited on the cobbles, kicking them once or twice in soft places.
"I reckon they're roistering in there, don't you?" said Tom John.
"It looks like that," said Howell.
He shivered. He hated taverns. People always put their drinks down on his head. They scurried in quickly while the troll was holding one unconscious drinker up by one leg and banging his head on the cobbles in search for concealed valuables. Drinking in the drum has been likened to diving in a swamp, except that in a swamp the alligators don't pick your pockets first. 200 eyes watched the pair as they pushed their way through the crowd to the bar. 100 mouths paused in the act of drinking, cursing or pleading, and 99 brows crinkled with the effort of working out whether the newcomers fell into category A, people to be frightened of, or B, people to frighten. Tom John walked through the crowd as though it was his property, and with the impetuosity of youth rapped on the bar. Impetuosity was not a survival trait in the mended drum.
2 pints of your finest ale, landlord," he said,
in tones so carefully judged that the barman was astonished to find himself obediently filling the first mug before the echoes had died away. Howell looked up. There was an extremely big man on his right, wearing the outside of several large bulls and more chains than necessary to moor a warship. A face that looked like a building site with hair on it glared down at him.
"Bloody hell," he said. "It's a bloody loan ornament."
Howell went cold. Cosmopolitan as they were, the people of Moorpork had a breezy, no-nonsense approach to the non-human races, i.e. hit them over the head with a brick and throw them in the river. This did not apply to trolls, naturally, because it's very difficult to be racially prejudiced against creatures 7 feet tall who can bite through walls, at least for very long. But people 3 feet high were absolutely designed to be discriminated against. The giant prodded Howell on the top of his head.
"Where's your fishing rod loan ornament?" he said.
The barman pushed the mugs across the puddled counter.
"Here you are," he said, leering. "1 pint and 1/2 pint.
Tom John opened his mouth to speak, but Howell nudged him sharply in the knee. "Put up with it, put up with it. Slip out as soon as possible. It was the only way."
"Where's your little pointy hat, then?" said the bearded man.
The room had gone quiet. This looked like being cabaret time.
"I said, where's your pointy hat, dopey?"
The barman got a grip of the blackthorn stick with nails in it, which lived under the counter just in case, and said,
I was talking to the loan ornament here.
The man took the dregs of his own drink and poured them carefully over the silent dwarf's head.
"I ain't drinking here again," he muttered.
Even this failed to have any effect.
"It's bad enough they let monkeys drink here, but pygmies."
Now the silence in the bar took on a whole new intensity in which the sound of a stool being slowly pushed back was like the creak of doom. All eyes swiveled to the other end of the room, where sat the one drinker in the mended drum who came into Category C. What Tom John had thought was an old sack hunched over the bar was extending arms, and other arms, except they were its legs. A sad, rubbery face turned towards the speaker, its expression as melancholy as the mists of evolution, its funny lips curled back. There was absolutely nothing funny about its teeth. Said the barman again, his voice frightening even him in that terrible simian silence.
"I don't think you meant that, did you? Not about monkeys, eh? You didn't really, did you?"
"What the hell is that?"
hissed Tom John.
"I think it's an orangutan,"
said Howell.
"An ape." "A monkey is a monkey," said the bearded man,
at which several of the drum's more percipient customers started to edge for the door.
"I mean..."
...than the rest of the city. This always amazes visitors.
"I'd like to see a troll tavern."
"They're for trolls only, boy. Molten lava to drink and rock music and cheese and chutney-flavoured pebbles."
"What about dwarf bars?"
"You'd hate it," said Howell fervently. "Besides, you'd run out of headroom."
"Low dives, are they?"
"Look at it like this. How long do you think you could sing about gold?"
"It's yellow and it goes chink, and you can buy things with it,"
said Tom John experimentally as they strolled through the crowds on the Plaza of Broken Moons.
"4 seconds, I think."
"Right. 5 hours of it. Gets a bit repetitive."
Howell kicked a pebble gloomily. He'd investigated a few dwarf bars last time they were in town and hadn't approved. For some reason, his fellow expatriates, who at home did nothing more objectionable than mine a bit of iron ore and hunt small creatures, felt impelled, once in the big city, to wear chain mail underwear, go around with axes in their belts, and call themselves names like Timkin Rumbleguts. And no one could beat a city dwarf when it came to quaffing. Sometimes they missed their mouths altogether.
"Anyway," he added, "you'd get thrown out for being too creative. The actual words are gold, 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 gold."
"Is there a chorus?"
"Gold, gold, 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 gold,"
said Howell.
"You left out a gold there."
"I think it's because I wasn't cut out to be a dwarf."
"Cut down? Lawn ornament?" said Tom John. There was a little hiss of indrawn breath.
"Sorry," said Tom John hurriedly. "It's just that father..."
"I've known your father for a long time," said Howell. "Through thick and thin, and there was a damn sight more thin than thick, since before you were bo-"
He hesitated.
"Times were hard in those days," he mumbled. "So what I'm saying is, well, some things you earn."
"Yes, I'm sorry."
"You see, just..."
Howell paused at the mouth of a dark alley.
"Did you hear something?"
he said. They squinted into the alley, once again revealing themselves as newcomers to the city. More Porkians don't look down dark alleys when they hear strange noises. If they see four struggling figures, their first instinct is not to rush to anyone's assistance. Or at least, not to rush to the assistance of the one who appears to be losing and on the wrong end of someone else's boot. Nor do they shout, "Oi!" Above all, they don't look surprised when the assailant, instead of guiltily running off, flourish a small piece of cardboard in front of them.
"What's this?"
said Tom John.
"It's a clown,"
said Howell.
They've mugged a clown.
Theft license? Said Tom John, holding the card up to the light.
That's right, said the leader of the three. Only don't expect us to do you two, because we're on our way home.
That's right,
said one of the assistants.
It's the thingy, the quarter.
But you were kicking him.
Well, not a lot. Not what you'd call actual kicking. More foot-nudging sort of thing, said the third thief. Fair's fair. He bloody well went and fetched Ron here a right thump, didn't he?
Yeah, some people have no idea. Why, you heartless...
Howell began, but Tom John laid a cautioning hand on his head. The boy turned the card over. The obverse read,
J.H. Flannelfoot, Boggess and Nephews, Bespoke Thieves, The Old Firm,
established A.M. 1789. All type theft carried out, professionally and with discretion.
Houses cleared, 24-hour service, no job too small. Let us quote you for our family rate.
It seems to be an order, he said reluctantly. Howell paused in the act of helping the dazed victim to his feet.
In order,
he shouted,
to rob someone?
We'll give him a chitty, of course, said Boggis. Lucky we found him first, really. Some of these newcomers in the business, they've got no idea.
Cowboys,
agreed a nephew. Ankh Morpork's enviable system of licensed criminals owes much to the current patrician, Lord Vetinari. He reasoned that the only way to police a city of 1 million inhabitants was to recognise the various gangs and robbers' guilds, give them professional status, invite the leaders to large dinners, allow an acceptable level of street crime, and then make the guild leaders responsible for enforcing it, on pain of being stripped of their new civic honours, along with large areas of their skin. It worked. Criminals, it turned out, made a very good police force. Unauthorised robbers soon found, for example, that instead of a night in the cells, they could now expect an eternity at the bottom of the river. However, there was the problem of apportioning the crime statistics. And so there arose a complex system of annual budgeting, chits and allowances to see that A, the members could make a reasonable living, and B, no citizen was robbed or assaulted more than an agreed number of times. Many foresighted citizens, in fact, arranged to get an acceptable minimum of theft, assault, etc., over at the beginning of the financial year, often in the privacy and comfort of their own homes, and thus be able to walk the streets quite safely for the rest of the year. It all ticked over extremely peacefully and efficiently, demonstrating once again that, compared to the patrician of Ankh, Machiavelli could not have run a whelk stall.
"How much did you steal?"
said Tom John. Boggis opened the clown's purse, which was stuck in his belt, then went pale.
"Oh, bleedin' hell," said.
The nephews clustered around.
"We're for it, sort of thing."
"Second time this year, Uncle."
Boggis glared at the victim.
"Well, how was I to know? I wasn't to know, was I? I mean, look at him. How much would you expect him to have on him? Couple of coppers, right? I mean, we'd never have done him, only it was on our way home. You try to do someone a favour, this is what happens."
"How much has he got, then?"
said Tom John.
"There must be 100 silver dollars in here," moaned Boggis, waving a purse. "I mean, that's not my league. That's not my class. I can't handle that sort of money. You've got to be in the Guild of Lawyers or something to steal that much. It's way over my quota, is that."
"Give it back, then," said Tom John.
"But I done him a receipt."
"They've all got, you know, number—"
striking his chainmail torso.
"And I say—"
Howell peered closer.
"Here, I know you," he said. "You got a cosmetics mill down up Fall Street. I bought a lot of grease paint off you last week."
A look of panic crossed Thundergust's face. He leaned forward in panic.
"Shut up, shut up," he whispered. That's right. It said, the Halls of Elvin Perfume and Rouge Co.,
said Howell happily.
Very good stuff,
said Tom John, who was trying to stop himself from sliding off the tiny bench.
Especially your number 19, Corpse Green. My father swears it's the best, first class.
The dwarf hefted his axe uneasily.
Weller, he said. Oh, but, yes, well, thank you. Only the finest ingredients, mark you. Chop them up with it, do you?
Said Howell innocently, pointing to the axe.
Or is it your night off?
Thundergust's brow beetled again like a cockroach convention.
Here, you're not with the theatre. There's us,
said Tom John.
Strolling players,
he corrected himself.
Standing still players now. Sliding down players now.
The dwarf dropped his axe and sat down on the bench, his face suddenly softened with enthusiasm.
I went last week, he said. Bloody good it was. There was this girl and this fella, but she was married to this old man, and there was this other fella, and they said he died, and she pined away and took poison. And then it turned out this man was the other man, really, only he couldn't tell her on account of...
Thundergust stopped and blew his nose.
Everyone died in the end,
he said.
Very tragic. I cried all the way home. I don't mind telling you. She was so pale. Number 19 and a layer of powder,
said Tom John cheerfully.
Plus a bit of brown eyeshadow. Eh? And a couple of hankies in the vest,
he added.
What's he saying?
Said the dwarf to the company at, for want of a better word, large. Howell smiled into his tankard.
Give him a bit of Gretelina's soliloquy, boy,
he said.
Right.
Tom John stood up, hit his head, sat down, and then knelt on the floor as a compromise. He clasped his hands to what would have been, but for a few chance chromosomes, his bosom.
You lie who call it summer,
he began. The assembled dwarfs listened in silence for several minutes. One of them dropped his axe and was noisily hushed by the rest of them.
And melting snow, farewell.
Tom John finished.
Drinks, Foyle. Collapses behind battlements, down ladder, out of dress, into tabard for comic guard number 2. Wait. Entrance left.
What? Ho!
Good!
That's about enough,
said Howell quietly. Several of the dwarfs were crying into their helmets. There was a chorus of blown noses. Thundergust dabbed at his eye with a chainmail handkerchief.
That was the most saddest thing I've ever heard,
he said. He glared at Tom John.
Hang on,
he said. A realization dawned.
He's a man. I bloody fell in love with that girl on stage.
He nudged Howell.
He's not a bit of an elf, is he?
Absolutely human,
said Howell.
I know his father.
Once again, he stared hard at the fool, who was watching them with his mouth open, and looked back at Tom John. He thought.
Coincidence.
It's acting,
he said.
A good actor can be anything, right?
He could feel the fool's eye boring into the back of his short neck.
Yes, but dressing up as women, it's a bit...
said Thundergust doubtfully. Tom John slipped off his shoes and knelt down on them, bringing his face level with the dwarf's. He gave him a calculating stare for a few seconds, and then adjusted his features. And there were 2 Thundergusts. True, one of them was kneeling, and had apparently been shaved.
What ho! What ho!
Said Tom John in the dwarf's voice. This was by way of being a hilarious gag to the rest of the dwarves, who had an uncomplicated sense of humour. As they gathered round the pair, Howell felt a gentle touch on the shoulder.
"You two are with the theatre," said the fool, now almost sober.
"That's right."
"Then I've come 500 miles to find you."
It was, as Hal would have noted in his stage directions, later the same day. The sound of hammering as the disc theatre rose from its cradle of scaffolding thumped through Howell's head and out the other side. He could remember the drinking, he was certain, and the dwarfs brought lots more rounds when Tom John did his impersonations. Then they had all gone to another bar, Thundergust knew, and then they had gone to a Cratchin takeaway, and after that, it was just a blur. He wasn't very good at quaffing. Too much of the drink actually landed in his mouth. Judging by the taste in it, some incontinent creature of the night had also scored a direct hit.
"Can you do it?"
said Bitola. Howell smacked his lips to get rid of the taste.
"I expect," said Tom John. "It sounded interesting, the way he told it. Wicked kings ruling with the help of evil witches, storms, ghastly forests, true heir to throne in life and death struggle, flash of dagger, screams, alarums, evil king dies, good triumphs, bells ring out."
"Showers of rose petals can be arranged," said Vitola. "I know a man who can get them at practically cost."
They both looked at Howell, who was drumming his fingers on his stool. All three found their attention drawn to the bag of silver the fool had given Howell. Even by itself, it represented enough money to complete the disc. And there had been talk of more to follow. Patronage, that was the thing.
"You will do it, then, will you?"
said Vitola.
"It's got a certain something,"
Howell conceded.
I don't know."
"I'm not trying to pressure you," said Vitola.
All three pairs of eyes swiveled back to the money bag.
"That?"
"Yes, Granny."
"Right. Let's see now."
"I wrote it all down, Granny."
"I can read, my girl, thank you very much. Now, what's this? Round about the cauldron go, in the poisoned entrails throw. What are these supposed to be?"
"Oh, Jason slaughtered a pig yesterday, Esme."
"These look like perfectly good chitterlings to me, Gaither. There's a couple of decent meals in them, if I'm any judge."
"Please, Granny."
"There's plenty of starving people in Clatch who wouldn't turn up their nose at 'em, that's all I'm saying. All right, all right. Whole grain wheat and lentils, too, in the cauldron seethe and stew. What happened to the toad?"
"Please, Granny, you're slowing it down. You know Goody was against all unnecessary cruelty. Vegetable protein is a perfectly acceptable substitute."
"That means no newt or fenny snake either, I suppose."
"No, Granny."
"Or tiger's children?"
"Here."
"What the hell's this? Excuse my clatching."
"It's a tiger's children. Our Wayne bought it off for a merchant from Fawn Parts."
"You sure?"
"Our Wayne, our special, Esme."
"Looks like any other children to me. Oh, well. Double hubbles, double trouble, fire burn and cauldron bu—" "Why isn't the cauldron bubbling, McGrath?"
Tom John awoke, shivering. The room was dark. Outside, a few stars pierced the mist of the city, and there was the occasional whistle of burglars and footpads as they went about their strictly lawful occasions. There was silence from the next room, but he could see the light of a candle under the door. He went back to bed. Across the turgid river, the fool had also awakened. He was staying at the Fool's Guild, not out of choice, but because the Duke hadn't given him any money for anything else, and getting to sleep had been difficult in any case. The chilly walls had brought back too many memories. Besides, if he listened hard, he could hear the muted sobs and occasional whimpers from the students' dormitories as they contemplated with horror the life that lay ahead of them. punched the rock-hard pillow and sank into a fitful sleep. A chance to dream.
Slab and grew, yes. But it doesn't say how slab and grew.
Goody Wimper recommended testing a bit in a cup of cold water like toffee.
How inconvenient that we didn't think to bring one, McGrath.
I think we should be getting on, Esme. The night's nearly gone.
Just don't blame me if it doesn't work properly, that's all. Let's see. Baboon hair and... Who's got the baboon hair? Oh, thank you, Gaither. That looks more like cat hair to me, but never mind. Baboon hair and mandrake root. And if that's real mandrake, I'm very surprised. Carrot juice and tongue of boot. I see. Little humour, I suppose.
Please hurry.
All right, all right. Owl hoot and glowworm glimmer. Boil and then allow to simmer.
You know, Esme, this doesn't taste half bad.
You're not supposed to drink it, you daft Oyen.
Tom John sat bolt upright in bed. That was them again. The same faces, the bickering voices, distorted by time and space. Even after he looked out of the window, where fresh daylight was streaming through the city, he could still hear the voices grumbling into the distance, like old thunder fading away.
I, for one, didn't believe it about the tongue of boot.
It's still very runny. Do you think we should put some corn flour in it?
It won't matter. Either he's on his way or he isn't.
He got up and doused his face in the wash basin. Silence rolled in swathes from Howell's room. Tom John slipped on his clothes and pushed open the door. It looked as though it had snowed indoors, great heavy flakes that had drifted into odd corners of the room. Howell sat at his low table in the middle of the floor, his head pillowed on a pile of paper, snoring. Tom John tiptoed across the room and piled up a discarded ball of paper at random. He smoothed it out and read, King, now I am just going to put the crown on this bush here, and you will tell me if anyone tries to take it, won't you? Groundlings,
yes.
King, now, if I could just find my horsey. First assassin pops up behind rock. Audience.
Behind you!
First assassin disappears. King.
You're trying to play tricks on old Kingy, you naughty.
There was a lot of crossing out and a large blot. Tom John threw it aside and selected another ball at random. King. Is this a... duck, knife, dagger? I see... behind... beside, in front of, before me, it's beak, handle, pointing at me, my hand. First murderer. Oh, no, it isn't.
If faith, it is not so.
Second murderer.
Oh, yes, it is. Thou speakest true, sir.
Judging by the creases in the paper, this one had been thrown at the wall particularly hard. Howell had once explained to Tom John his theory about inspirations, and by the look of it, a whole shower had fallen last night. Fascinated by this insight into the creative processes, however, Tom John tried a third discarded attempt. Queen.
Faith, there is a sound without.
Mayhap it is my husband returning.
Quick, into the guardy robe. And wait not upon the order of your going.
Murderer.
Marry, but your maid still has my pantoufle.
Maid, opening door.
The Archbishop, your Majesty.
Priest, under bed.
Bless my soul.
Divers alarums. Tom John wondered vaguely what divers alarums, which Howell always included somewhere in the stage directions, actually were. Howell always refused to say. Perhaps they referred to dangerous depths, or lack of air pressure. He sidled towards the table, and with great care, put pulled the sheaf of paper from under the sleeping dwarf's head, lowering it gently.